Hello, Mark.
Hey, Sean, how you doing?
Good. So, welcome to Blocking Heads.
Thanks.
I'm a little bit of the veteran, so I'm Sean Carroll, physicist at Caltech and blogger at Cosmic Variance. And we thought this time it would be fun to have a talk about actual cosmology, the universe, the thing that people like me do for a living. So we invited my co-blogger, Mark Trodden, also from Cosmic Variance. So, Mark, why don't you tell the crowd about yourself?
So I'm Mark Trodden. I'm a professor at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Physics and Astronomy. And I work on, a lot of different aspects of cosmology. I work on the early universe, the late universe, cosmic acceleration, the whole shebang. Sometimes I work with Sean, sometimes I work with other people. And as Sean said, I also blog at Cosmic Variance, which is a lot of fun.
Yeah, we got to know each other when we were both postdocs at MIT, which was like four or more academic stops ago.
I like the fact that you don't go into number of years. That's very diplomatic.
No, years is not relevant. So. all right, so we thought that, yeah, we would actually talk about substance of science today. In particular, I first thought that maybe we could talk about what are the big issues in cosmology, but then I realized there's probably too many of that. So we'll see how this one goes, and if it goes well, then we'll talk about more big issues in some future installment.
That sounds good.
And if we have a terrible fight and aren't speaking to each other anymore, then that would also be good for ratings, I think.
Yeah, it would certainly cut down on my workload in the future.
Yeah. So instead, let's focus on one issue, which is a pretty good one, which is what is the universe made of?
Right.
And as you know, in the last years of the 20th century, there were lots of great advances. We really put together an inventory of the stuff the universe is made of. Actually, why don't you give us the overall view of the recipe itself for the universe, and then we can go back and forth about, I think we want to do a little bit about what we all agree on, what everyone agrees on, what every good working cosmologist agrees on, but we certainly do want to spend some time on the controversies and some open questions.
That sounds good. So I think the sort of normal thing that cosmologists start off talking about, and certainly we all start our colloquia this way, is to talk about the pie chart. So what we really mean by that is, when you look out in the universe on the largest scales and you sort of weigh a big enough patch of it, you find that there are sort of three major components to the universe. One of them is the kind of stuff that we're made of, which we call baryons, which is, which means a lot of things, but for our purposes really just means protons and neutrons. So then, there's another big chunk, much bigger actual
chunk.
And also
we should just say, for people who don't know the numbers, it also includes electrons and all that other stuff. It's just that they're not...
It's just that they're...
Weight. All the ordinary matter in the universe. Yeah.
That's right. All the ordinary stuff. And then, there's this thing which everyone has heard of called dark matter, which I'm sure we're going to discuss quite a bit, and that comprises actually a much larger chunk of the universe, maybe as much as five times as much as the regular stuff that we're made of. And then there's sort of a whole other thing going on in the universe, which I'm sure we're going to talk about, which is that the universe these days looks like it's accelerating. And the way I like to say it is that, if you think gravity behaves according to Einstein's theory of general relativity, which we really have no good reason to think it doesn't nowadays, then, in fact, there's a whole other part of the pie chart which corresponds to the stuff that is causing the universe to get bigger faster. And that can go under a number of names, and one of them is dark energy. So there are other things in the universe, of course. There are neutrinos. There potentially are lots of exotic things. But those are the three major chunks we mean when we talk of what the universe is made of.
Right. So the final percentages are something like 5% ordinary matter, 20% dark matter, 75% dark energy.
Something like that.
Would you agree with those numbers?
They're close enough for a theorist.
Close enough. We're rounding out to 5%.
Right.
And so that 5%, which is ordinary matter, really includes every single particle we've ever discovered in a laboratory, everything we've ever made, every atom, every bit of stuff. And both the dark matter and the dark energy we think are different things, and we should talk a little bit about why we think that. So let's start with the dark matter, because there's things to say about the ordinary matter even, but the dark matter is something everyone knows is mysterious. So first, we have good reason to believe that there is dark matter, and it's not a perfect reason. We should say that there are people who don't believe in dark matter, but there are a dwindling number of people. The evidence goes all the way back to Fritz Zwicky, my Caltech predecessor, back in the 1930s. And all he did was compare the motions of galaxies in the coma cluster of galaxies to the amount of matter you could see. So he would look at the galaxy. He you would count the stars, you'd figure out how much the stars weighed and so forth, add up how much matter there should be. And then he would look at the galaxies moving around each other, and they're pulled by their mutual gravitational force. So the more stuff that is in the galaxies, the more matter is in the galaxies, the more stuff there is, the faster they should be moving. And Zwicky found that they were moving a lot faster than they should have, that if you just put together the total amount of matter that you could tell was there by looking at it, it was not nearly enough to account for the motions of the galaxies. The thing was, of course, back in those days, they didn't know that you just weren't missing something. That, in fact, it was very possible that there was matter in the galaxies that was dark matter in the sense that it wasn't shining, but it was nevertheless ordinary matter. And I think the thing that became increasingly clear in the 1970s, and certainly most people believe today, is that the dark matter, the total amount of matter that you need to explain the dynamics of the universe in many, many different ways, can't be ordinary matter. And probably, I guess there's different lines of evidence for that, but probably the best one is from nucleosynthesis, right?
Yes, right. Yeah, I think, I mean, well, I'm sure we'll talk about nucleosynthesis later when we talk about the regular matter, but it's true that, you know, we have this very successful accounting of the lightest elements in the universe, which is quite amazing, I think. I mean, you just take the standard cosmology, which tells you that the universe is expanding today, getting bigger. You run that back in time, and if you run it back far enough, you, of course, end up with an early, hot, dense universe. And at some point, it's hot enough that one can have, in fact, nuclear fusion occurring. And, you know, that nuclear fusion happens for a short time at the beginning of the universe, happens for just the first couple of minutes or so, 3 minutes, and the universe is expanding very rapidly at that time, so you've got this sort of plasma that is undergoing nuclear fusion and cooling rapidly. And so fusion creates just a few lightest elements, and then it's over. There's no heat left to produce the heavier ones. And those lightest elements are produced in very specific abundances. And those actual abundances, which are very precisely tested against observations these days, depend on a couple of things. They depend on how the universe was expanding at that time, and they depend on how much stuff in the universe is the stuff that we're made of. And from that alone, you know that it's impossible to have as much as we need dark matter to be made up of regular matter. We need only a small amount of regular matter. Dark matter has to be something else. Otherwise, we would have no understanding of how the light elements came to be.
Yeah, so I think that's a really big thing that we don't always get across in the 2-minute version of the dark matter story, which is why it's good we have an hour version of the story, which is that we really do have independent ways of measuring, putting upper limits on the amount of ordinary matter in the universe, and it's just not enough. And nucleosynthesis is one way, and another way more modern in the last 10 years is the cosmic microwave background.
That's right.
We look at, you know, we have a universe that, like Mark said, it was hot and dense at early times, and it was also, therefore, opaque because it was so hot and dense that individual atoms couldn't stick together. You had the electrons and the protons and so forth just flying around freely, and that's an opaque universe. You would not be able to see your hand in front of your face because the photons would keep bumping into the electrons.
Your hand would have other problems, of course.
But you have other problems, too, but this is thought experiment land. So... but then at some point, 380,000 years after the Big Bang or thereabouts, it cools off enough, the fog lifts, you can suddenly see, and the radiation flies toward us, and we see that radiation as the cosmic microwave background. 380,000 years after the Big Bang, now we're 14 billion years after the Big Bang, so that's a very early snapshot. And then you can analyze, this is a longer story than I thought it was going to be, then you look at the cosmic microwave background, the relic radiation from the earliest few hundred thousand years after the Big Bang. And you see that it's almost the same temperature everywhere, but not quite. There's tiny fluctuations in temperature. And if you look at the patterns of fluctuations in temperature from here to there, they're caused by gravitational processes, things falling into each other. And then there's a complicated story of dark matter could be falling in one way, ordinary matter could be falling in another way, and so forth. Then you ask yourself, given the data that we see, given the particular patterns of temperature fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background, how do you best understand that in terms of both dark matter that doesn't touch the photons at all and ordinary matter that does? And again, you get the same kind of answer, which is that the ordinary matter is not enough to account for what you see. So it's not just that the moral of the story is that it's not just that we haven't been looking hard enough for stars and gas and invisible things in the universe. You really need some new kind of particle to be the dark matter.
I think, I mean, it's a very good point. It's a crucial thing that I think a lot of people outside of the field aren't often told, which is it's true that when we look at galaxies and clusters of galaxies today, their dynamics is such that we seem to need something called dark matter that will cause them to hold together in the way that they do. And that's a very compelling story and a lot of evidence for dark matter. But what's not often emphasized is that if we didn't have dark matter, cosmology would just not have unfolded in the way it did. And in particular, the largest structures in the universe, it wouldn't just be that they would look the way they did but would have no dark matter and would rotate differently. They just wouldn't be there. Structure would not form. So dark matter plays crucial roles throughout the history of the universe.
And so what is it?
What is dark matter?
Yeah. What is the particle?
It's... I'm glad you asked that. I chose this time to... seems like a good time to tell people. So we, of course, have absolutely no idea. Well, that's not quite true. We don't know, but dark matter, I think, is a very successful example of the interplay between particle physics and cosmology, because although we don't know what dark matter is, I would say we have a lot of rather well-motivated ideas, and I should say what I mean by well-motivated.
There are too many of them.
There are too many ideas. I wouldn't say there are too many well-motivated ideas. But one thing that we really love is the idea that dark matter could be something called a WIMP. And WIMP is an acronym. It means weakly interacting massive particle. And the idea is that the early universe was this hot soup, and particles were being created, and then they were meeting other particles and annihilating away into radiation. And this was continuing on, but as the universe cooled, sooner or later it becomes hard for particles to find other particles with which to annihilate, and particles, as we say in cosmology, freeze out. You end up with some leftover abundance of particles in the universe, and the amount of these particles that's left over depends on their mass and their coupling to other particles and their couplings to each other and the rate at which the universe is expanding, et cetera, et cetera. So that's a complicated story. But
the point is that given some idea of what the particle physics is, how they annihilate, how they interact, blah, 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 we can predict how many of them there should be in the current universe.
That's right. So we know how to do it. It involves complicated computer programs, but things that just input really how these particles interact. And that's all particle physics, of course. And one very nice thing is that if you ask what is the typical scale, energy scale in the universe that particle masses and interactions should be in order to give you the right amount of dark matter, the scale you find is a scale that we call the weak scale. And that is a scale that is A, just above the range of our current generation of particle accelerators. So that's rather tantalizing for things like the Large Hadron Collider, the big machine that's being built at CERN on the Swiss-French border. But also, it's rather tantalizing for another reason, which is that there are a bunch of issues in the standard model of particle physics, which describes all known particle phenomena. And those issues, one of which is called the hierarchy problem, it's roughly speaking, why is it that particle physics interactions have such different strengths to gravity? Why can you pick up a paperclip with a magnet when the entire force of the Earth is pulling it down with gravity? And our ideas about what should cure that hierarchy problem involve new physics at this weak scale. And inevitably, new physics throws around new particles and new symmetries and new interactions. And so it's very exciting, the possibility that that physics, which we would need for particle physics reasons, nothing to do with cosmology, independently may be handing as a good candidate for the missing 25% of the universe or so.
I think that we really need to come up with some better names here. This is, we use WIMPs and the weak scale, and people who are not professional cosmologists are not going to be very impressed with the grandeur of our concepts. But but you're right about the weak scale. I was thinking about just this morning. I think that there's the particle physicists organize the world into energy scales or mass scales because E equals mc squared. And if you were going to pick an energy scale at which you thought, given what we know about particle physics right now, where is the most interesting energy scale of all? One single one. And other than the Planck scale, which is characteristic of gravity and way beyond our reach, it's far too high, you'd pick the weak scale. The weak scale
That's
is
right.
really where the action is in particle physics.
And
we haven't yet probed it directly and experimentally in any complete way. The most massive particle we've been able to make in a particle accelerator is the top quark, which has a mass about a little bit less than 200 times the mass of a proton. And it's still a little bit lower than the weak scale. So it's hard to get across to some people sometimes the excitement that we have due to the LHC. It's just another particle accelerator, right? We've had plenty of particle accelerators.
That's right.
We'll hopefully have them in the future. But I think that you can make a good case that the LHC is looking into the single most important place to look when it comes to particle physics, and we haven't looked there yet. Who knows what we will find? And one of the exciting aspects of that is that there's good reasons to believe that one of the things we could find there is a particle that could be the dark matter.
That's right. I mean, I don't think you would build a gigantic collider just on the chance that you would find dark matter. But given that, as you say, this is the most interesting energy scale for particle physics considerations, other than the Planck scale, of course, is an independent fact. It's nothing to do with cosmology. And I just find it fascinating that it could have such important ramifications for the universe. And finding dark matter is just one of them, of course, and I'm sure we may talk about other ones later. But if you were to turn on the Large Hadron Collider, and perhaps future accelerators also, and be able to discover new particles, new symmetries that relate those particles to the particles we know and love, and isolate one with the right mass and the right types of interactions, strengths of interactions, such that when you throw it into our calculations about the universe, it tells us it would have the right abundance to be dark matter, I think that would be an extremely compelling result. We would still then need, you know, wonderful cosmological experiments in order to find out if we could independently measure that particle in the universe as a particle, not through its large-scale gravitational behavior. But it would be such a wonderful result to find it in a collider.
And we should mention, I actually think that, you know, one of the easiest, or at least crazy predictions to make for exciting new developments in particle physics over the next 5 or 10 years, many of them are dark matter related. Of course, the LHC that's supposed to be turning on later this year is an obvious one, but we're also looking for dark matter through direct detection. We're building giant laboratories underground that are hoping to capture or observe the effects of dark matter particles. And we're looking at dark matter in the universe. If you have dark matter that is a weakly interacting massive particle, a WIMP, it turns out that half of the dark matter is dark particles and half are dark antiparticles, WIMPs and anti-WIMPs. And they will occasionally annihilate, not that often because they only interact very, very weakly. Most of the time, they just zoom right by each other. But they'll occasionally annihilate. They'll make high-energy photons that are gamma rays. So if you take a gamma-ray telescope and you point it somewhere where there's supposed to be a lot of dark matter, like the center of our galaxy, you might be able to see the effects of these dark matter particles annihilating. And happily, not too long ago, a few months ago, in late 2008, NASA and the Department of Energy launched a gamma-ray telescope, the Fermi telescope, which is collecting its first data right now. The trick will be analyzing the data and figuring out, they'll see gamma rays at the galactic center. The trick is where they will come from. Is it from dark matter or from something else?
That's right. And it's worth saying that, you know, we sort of think we know we should point to the galactic center because although dark matter, you know, it doesn't interact very strongly, there should still be sort of more of it near the center of a big, massive object like the galaxy than there should be toward the edges, a higher density of it. So the chances of it bumping into one of its antiparticles are much higher there. That's right. And so, of course, in the last year, we've had some tantalizing suggestions that there may have been observations of dark matter annihilations. There were a couple of experiments, the Pamela experiment and the Attic experiment. I'm told you should pronounce Pamela in the Italian way.
Pamela, yes.
Right. And these reported results that at least were consistent with the idea that dark matter could be annihilating, but which had some quirky features. For the example, if it were dark matter annihilations, it would have to be predominantly annihilating into certain types of particles, like electrons, let's say, rather than annihilating into protons.
Right.
And that is something that, you know, hordes of theorists have been trying to explain with a new set of models. I think Fermi, the hope is that Fermi will be able to settle that question in a way that these other experiments have not been able to.
We'll see, yeah. And we should also mention it, you know, it's only a couple of years ago, but nevertheless exciting, and it's a segue into something else. The Bullet Cluster. The idea, so we saw this image of two clusters of galaxies passing right through each other. And if you really wanted to be sure that there was dark matter involved, what you could do is use the fact that dark matter is dark. It doesn't interact. It just passes right through, whereas ordinary matter smacks into other ordinary matter and lights up. So they found an example in the universe where two clusters of galaxies went through each other. And indeed, the ordinary matter smacked into the ordinary matter in one cluster, smacked into the ordinary matter of the other cluster. You could see a shock wave, which is why it was called the bullet cluster in the first place. But then you could also use gravitational lensing to weigh the clusters to figure out where the matter was. And most of the matter in these congregations had been separated out from the ordinary matter that we saw glowing in X-rays. So the only way that makes sense to us is if, in fact, most of the matter is something new, is not ordinary matter, is dark matter, and it's exactly the right kind of situation to fit what we thought the qualities of dark matter should be. But then I use this bullet cluster, and I sometimes write on our blog or somewhere else, now we know that dark matter exists. And I get hate mail from some fellow cosmologists who say, no, we don't. It's still possible to come up with something that does not have any dark matter at all. So what do you think about that?
Well, I think my take on it is similar to yours. I think the idea that the phenomena, the collective set of phenomena that we think of dark matter as explaining could be due to some other effect, namely a modification of gravity. And you know, as you well know, there's a proposed idea that was a sort of very down and dirty idea, if you like, due to Milgram, called modified Newtonian dynamics, that would explain this. And that's been now all dressed up pretty as a nice theory called Bekenstein's Tevis theory. And that the idea of that is that you could replace dark matter with it. But my feeling is it's not ruled out that you could do this. It's true. But things like the bullet cluster are a very important nail in the coffin. And it's becoming extremely hard to wiggle out of that. So my understanding is that even the current theories that of modifying gravity in a way that you could hope to explain something like the bullet cluster still require some dark matter at all. And if you're going to have dark matter, you might as well just have a lot of it.
I think that's right. And there's, in fact, it was sort of true even before the bullet cluster came along. The reason why anyone would bother thinking about MOND or modifying gravity. Well, number one, you always should be careful, right? So it would be much cooler, in my opinion, if gravity were modified than if there were dark matter. So of course you're going to hope that somehow there's not dark matter, but maybe our extrapolation using Einstein's general theory of relativity is wrong, and what we're seeing is actually a clue to some new kind of gravity. But that was number one. But number two was, when you looked at different galaxies, even though different galaxies have different sizes and different masses and so forth, there was a radius away from the middle of the galaxy where it always was true that dark matter became important only outside that radius. It was not the same radius for every galaxy, but it was a radius where the acceleration due to gravity, right, that Isaac Newton would have calculated, was always the same amount, no matter, yes, how big the galaxy was or how small the galaxy was. So there's this remarkable uniformity in different galaxies in saying where the dark matter became important.
Yeah, and I mean, the existence of this special acceleration scale,
right,
seems just true, and it's a challenge to explain that with dark matter, that's sure.
That's right. So if you believe in dark matter, this is an amusing coincidence that we don't quite yet know how to explain. If you had a new theory of gravity, Michael will put it in from the start.
Right.
But nevertheless, it's important to say that that idea just never worked for clusters of galaxies.
Right.
It's not true that you could plug in that idea. You could plug in that idea and fit a lot of galaxies. You could not fit clusters of galaxies without invoking some sort of dark matter or another. So
that's right. And to get back to what we discussed earlier, I mean, you know, trying to then extrapolate that and come up with an entire consistent cosmic history of structure formation working in the right way without dark matter, but with instead a modification to gravity, is an extremely tall order.
Yeah, it's not just people, you know, that someone who has a new theory of dark matter, modified gravity, shouldn't be taken seriously when all they talk about are the rotation curves of spiral galaxies. One of the first solid pieces of evidence of dark matter was Vera Rubin and others in the 1970s looked at how gas orbited spiral galaxies and kept orbiting at the same speed no matter how far you got away from the galaxy. That's good evidence for dark matter. It could also be explained by modifying gravity. But now, in the early days of the 21st century, we have a lot better evidence for dark matter than that, and it's not enough just to fit that one sort of phenomenon. You have to fit a whole set of ideas. And so it's becoming to the point where it's almost not that interesting to think about modifying gravity anymore. It's always possible. It's logically possible. But I think that it's safe to say the idea is losing traction in most of the community.
I think that's true. I mean, there are a lot of interesting ideas people are trying to come up with. Theorists are extremely creative and clever, and there are a lot of good ideas that have been put forward. But I do think that it's becoming harder and harder to really defend modified gravity as a replacement for dark matter. But, you know, on that topic, you know, there's this whole other part of the universe that I alluded to at the beginning, namely the bit that's causing the universe to accelerate. And we normally talk about that as dark energy, and we can certainly have a chat about that. But, of course, one natural thing you would ask there is, well, maybe modified gravity is responsible for that. And so what do you think about that?
Well, I think that that's a very obvious thing to think about. So the universe is accelerating. That's a surprise. If you only knew about ordinary matter and dark matter and Einstein's general theory of relativity, you would expect that as the universe expands, it expands ever more slowly because galaxies are moving apart, but then they're pulling on each other, so that expansion rate should slow down. And in fact, one of the teams that went out to test this idea had the subtitle of their team name was measuring the deceleration of the universe. But as we know, in 1998, two different teams looking at supernovae both came back with the same result, which is that the universe is accelerating. Cannot be explained if you believe in general relativity with nothing but matter and radiation. So either you throw away general relativity or you invent some new stuff, which we call dark energy. But throwing away general relativity in that case, I think, is at least a priori a much more plausible game to play. Number one, we don't know as much about the purported dark energy as we do about the dark matter. There's much less detailed knowledge because we only have one universe, whereas we have many, many galaxies and many, many ways in which dark matter shows up.
Right.
And number two, it's sort of just one number we have to fit in one ultra super large scale phenomenon. It's the expansion of the whole universe. So you and I have certainly looked at ideas, written down different models to try to explain the acceleration of the universe by modifying gravity. Other people also have. Everyone, again, thinks it would be really cool if that were true. But at the end of the day, after having done this for many years, my own personal view is that more or less, this is not very interesting. At least the models that have been looked at so far, none of those models, I think, actually makes the situation better than just considering dark energy. Again, it's not an open and shut case. It's not airtight. It's not a rigorous proof. I'm very, very willing to let other people put effort into coming up with ideas of modifying gravity to explain the acceleration of the universe. But I personally moved on. I'm ready to say that it's dark energy, that I'm ready to bet that it is dark energy and put my research hours into something else.
Yeah, I mean, I think I would agree with your take on the status of current models of modifying gravity to get cosmic acceleration. I think there aren't any proposed ideas that have not either run into serious trouble or are just expressible as other ideas which have already been out there. I still think it's an interesting thing for people to be doing, mostly for the reasons that you said. I don't know that I'm ready to say it's dark energy and move on. I think one interesting thing in cosmology that's happened over the last 10 years, let's say, is that it used to be that if you had a new idea for something that was going on in cosmology, it was enough to really fit the expansion history of the universe and get that right. And we have good handles on the expansion history of the universe, and that's a nice thing for your theory to satisfy. But nowadays, of course, we know so much about structure in the universe due to these tremendous experimental probes, which, you know, have not only flown but are continuing to fly, that there are a lot of other pieces of data that proposed models must fit. So I don't think it's one number anymore. You need to fit.
No, that's right. And it's
you need to get the expansion.
It becomes much harder to have a theory.
Yeah, it's ruined the fun that we were having with models. It's really inconsiderate of observers to have done this to us.
Definitely.
But nowadays we have to fit, you know, structure formation, we have to fit lensing, we have to fit, you know, the dynamics of clusters.
Yeah.
It's annoying. And as a result, many, many, many models don't survive. But those that do make interesting predictions.
This might become overly technical, but there are two models that people are looking at more than any others. And one of them is partially our fault. Do you want to say what these are? Maybe you can give a shot.
Sure. We wrote a paper, and many, many other people followed up on this in lots of detail, where we suggested that if you took the equations that Einstein wrote down for general relativity, there's a way to derive those equations from a nice compact mathematical procedure called an action principle. And we propose that you change that action in a rather obvious way. And these theories have a name. They're called the F of R theories. And that's a rather boring. F of R is in a function of something called R, which is the Ricci scalar. And the real point here is just that you're changing the Einstein's equations in a very specific way. And it's an entire class of theories. It is equivalent to a class of theories with a type of dark energy in it, something called quintessence, but with very weird couplings to other matter in the universe. And those theories have been considered in great detail, and they've run up against all kinds of problems, although some classes of them still survive. And people are trying to tease out more and more details to compare them with upcoming missions.
Right. I mean, the good thing, the bad thing about these theories is that there is, for all intents and purposes, a new field in the universe that changes the dynamics. Right. That's a good thing and that's a bad thing. It's a good thing if you're a model builder trying to fit data because it gives you another thing to play with to try to fit the data, and the data can be fit. And it's a bad thing because it's physics and you're not allowed to just put in a new field and say it only does what I want. There are equations that tell you what it does. And once you say, I want it to make the universe accelerate, that also fixes other things that it does. And this field gets you in trouble. It's very hard, for example, to be in complete agreement with experiments that test gravity in the solar system. So one of the things that these many follow-up papers have done is to really work very hard and to try to be clever and have come up with versions of this idea, changing Einstein's equation in a relatively simple, straightforward way, which both make the universe accelerate and are consistent with tests of gravity in the solar system, which I think is great. But the fact that they have to work so hard, I also think should, in all fairness, count against the viability of the model. It's not a complete argument against it, but it doesn't just fall into your lap and succeed.
I agree with that completely. And it is a remarkable thing about general relativity that you don't just get to change it on the scales where you'd like to change it. It insists on feeding those changes through into all kinds of scales. Who would have thought that when you wanted to change a theory in such a way that it only affected things at the very edge of the observable universe, that if you weren't extremely careful, the solar system would misbehave massively. That's and right. Yet it's yes. True.
Yeah, and so again, it's just like we said before, it's not a set of facts, and you can fit one fact and not worry about the others. There's a structure, and everything feeds back into everything else.
That's right.
Speaking of which, so the other very relatively popular idea for modifying gravity is something called DGP gravity, after Diwali, Gavadatta, and Porati. And these guys, unlike you and I, who were simple-minded, bottom-up kind of people, they were sophisticated, and they said, what if there's an extra dimension? What if the strength of gravity is very, very different in that extra dimension than it is in our three-dimensional world? So we imagine that space actually has four dimensions, not three dimensions. Plus, there's time, so it's a four-plus-one-dimensional universe rather than a five-plus-one-dimensional universe. But we're stuck on some tiny little space within the four dimensions, so we're stuck on some three-dimensional plane. We can't see the extra dimension. But gravity is very different out there. And they showed that. It was the nice thing about that theory was that they didn't try to explain the acceleration of the universe. That was not their goal. They were just wondering, right, how big can we make an extra dimension without noticing? And they found they could make it infinitely big. But the interesting thing was that when they wrote down their equations, again, the equations tell you what can happen. You don't get to make choices. And the equations said that even without dark energy, there would be a solution where the universe was accelerating as well as expanding. So that got people very excited about that model.
It's true, and a lot of work has gone into trying to tease out the cosmological implications of that model. But it's worth pointing out that, you know, I mentioned earlier this interplay between particle physics and cosmology. And if you take that model, and it's actually true if you take generalizations of the model that I spoke about earlier, these F of R models, if you generalize those, then both these types of models run into one sort of particle physics-y problem, which is that they seem to predict a very weird kind of matter in the theory. And that matter, it gets all kinds of names. It gets called a ghost.
Ghosts
and other things. But now, really what matters...
Wimps, not a very good name, but ghosts.
Wimps is a good name. I think we should keep Wimps.
Right.
It only gets ruined when it's an acronym. GHOST isn't an acronym. It's just one of those things.
Well, we could make it an acronym. That'd be good. I never
thought. Yeah, that's going to take longer than this to do that, to come up with something clever there. but these GHOSTs are really
ghosts bad.
They're bad because they're essentially negative energy particles.
Oh, that's right.
And if you have negative energy particles, the problem is that if you have good old empty space with nothing in it, what's to stop that empty space making a bunch of positive energy particles, like electrons and protons,
right,
and a bunch of negative energy particles to compensate and still have no energy? And so, as we would say in physics, the vacuum is unstable. And that's sort of a bad thing.
Yeah. I agree, it's a bad thing. So someone should write a paper saying that.
They should write a paper saying that. We did write a very nice paper together.
That's right. Oh, we should be famous. We're writing all these good papers.
It's true.
So, yeah, that's right.
I didn't realize this was about shameless promotion. I would have prepared.
It's, you know, I waited until 45 minutes, so only the hardcore people in here are still watching now.
But, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so DGP gravity has a sort of intrinsic problem with ghosts. There's different solutions to the equations of motion, blah, 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 but the solution that is intriguing and that you like, the one that makes the universe accelerate, actually predicts these things that you don't like, these ghosts, and so that is a problem. There's another problem, which is that unlike our model of modifying Einstein's equation, the DGP gravity is actually fairly well-defined all by itself. There's not any room to play. There's just one new number that comes into the game.
And yeah, that's a very nice feature. I agree.
It's a nice feature, but sadly it doesn't quite fit. I mean, it doesn't actually seem to fit the data very well. It's you have to sort of bend over backwards and ignore this and that to make it actually get the right acceleration history. So it seems that, so again, I think that, you know, it's a very, very obvious thing to think about, modifying gravity to explain the acceleration of the universe. It might have been the case that as soon as you started to do that, you said, oh, of course, it had to be this, and then you figured it out, and it not only fit the acceleration of the universe, but had other good things. What we find is that if we bend over backwards, we can fit the acceleration of the universe, but we also get these bad things. And it might just be that we're not smart enough, but it might just be that Einstein was smart, general relativity is right, and we're stuck with the dark energy.
I think Einstein was smart independently of the answer to this question.
Smart. Yes, that is true.
but I basically agree with the tack that you've taken. I mean, I think there are still interesting questions to ask in this topic, and you know, I'm actually thinking about some of these now. There are clever ways that one can try to cure ghosts in these models. And the question I find interesting is, It is very interesting to see if you can explain cosmic acceleration with models like this. But more interestingly is, for me, is trying to really get a handle on the ways in which general relativity can be played with.
Right.
To what extent is it, you know, really the only thing we're going to be left with at low energies? I think many people, in fairness, would say, we know that already, we're done. From my own perspective, I'm still sort of enjoying playing with it. But I think I would agree with your general take on the status of these models, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting. I mean, we did learn something. It still might be true in some genius. One of your graduate students might figure it out tomorrow. But we learned something by trying and not coming up with a more compelling theory than general relativity.
Right.
Which is about the sort of the delicacy of general relativity. If you try to change it in some way or another, it breaks. It really is sort of a very nice, robust theory all by itself.
Right.
But if you mess with it, you get in trouble.
Yeah, that's true.
Then you're left with the dark energy, and so that's a problem. So what do you think about just the cosmological constant? Is it acceptable?
Well, it works, which is about all you can ask from an observational viewpoint. I mean, a universe which has the amount of dark matter we talked about at the very beginning, you know, 20% or so, 5% the stuff we're made of, and what's the rest? 75% cosmological constant, one number, made just put in by hand at the right value. That works. It satisfies all known cosmological observations.
Right. And so just to be clear, the thing that you're putting in is you're saying that empty space itself has some intrinsic energy, that every little bit of space, even if there's no stuff in it, there's no matter, there's no photons, there's no dark matter, anything, you can ask how much energy is there in that empty cubic centimeter of space,
mm-hmm.
the answer is some number. There's no reason in physics for empty space to have zero energy. It was Einstein who first raised the possibility it could have energy. And so the idea of the cosmological constant or the vacuum energy says that there is, in fact, a number that is not zero. It's something like 10 to the minus 8 ergs per cubic centimeter. And it's everywhere in the universe, and that is the dark energy, just the inherent energy of empty space. And as far as we can tell, that one statement, one number, seems to fit all the data that is coming in cosmology right now.
That's right. And of course, this wouldn't be such a problem if it were not for the tight connection between particle physics and cosmology. Because I think, you know, if this were just a number that you had to put into Einstein's equations and it never spoke to anything else in the world, then you might just say, oh, what a strange number. But in fact, we know that that number there are many different things that can contribute to the size of that number. And in particular, quantum mechanical fluctuations in all the matter we know in the universe contributes to that number. And any sort of calculation we attempt to do to figure out what the size of that number should be always comes out to be far, far, far too large for what's needed for cosmic acceleration. In fact, it comes out to be far, far, far too large than what would be needed to have the universe look anything like it does today at all. And so the big question is not so much, you know, why don't we just choose that one number and be done with it, but why would a number of such a ridiculously small value be chosen from a set of theories that naturally generate much larger numbers?
Yeah, it's another one of these things that is not a straightforward disagreement between theory and experiment. It's a disagreement That's right. between expectation and reality. We have a number, there's a vacuum energy, there's nothing wrong with having a vacuum energy, but it's a very unnatural number. If you had not known ahead of time what it should be, you could have guessed, you could have estimated, there's a natural place for it to be, and the real world number is just some, the number that we throw around is 10 to the minus 120 times the number that you would have estimated. So a lot of people, but certainly most prominently among them, Steven Weinberg, Nobel Prize winning physicist, have suggested that the answer is because if the vacuum energy did have the size that it could have, we wouldn't be here blogging headzing about it. We would not exist. The universe would have been torn to shreds in a tiny fraction of an instant after the Big Bang. So Weinberg and other people say, if the vacuum energy takes on very, very different values from place to place in the universe, and by different places in the universe, we mean places that are far, far outside the regime where we can possibly see right now in our observable universe. Many, many places, many, many millions of light years away. Well, then, in those regions where the vacuum energy is as big as it should be, there's no one talking about it. There's a selection effect. There's just no observers there. There's no intelligent life. And then in those regions where the vacuum energy is mild and not very noticeable, so you require highly trained astronomers to even detect it, then you can have a flourishing civilization and an internet and blogging heads and things like that. So this idea, the anthropic principle, the idea that we're seeing a selection effect because the vacuum energy is not a once-and-for-all fixed constant in nature, it's an environmental thing, it's like the weather, takes on different aspects from place to place and from time to time, and therefore, we only see the small cosmological constant for the same reason we live on Earth and not on Jupiter or Saturn or on the surface of the Sun. Namely, it's more hospitable here. What do you think of that?
Well, you know, as a card-carrying theoretical cosmologist, I know at this point I'm either supposed to lovingly embrace the idea and say, finally, something that explains it. All my head is supposed to just pop off.
Yes, something dramatic anyway. Off the table. Please.
Right. I think my general attitude is more just, meh. And the reason is that I think the anthropic explanation for the cosmological constant is a perfectly logical one. It is, there is no argument, I think, that the world could not be that way.
But isn't it the death of science?
It's not the death of science. But I hope not. But to me, the question is just, I mean, I think it's an interesting question. Whether this is the case, my personal take on it is that we don't know enough about our theories to know how to ask that question yet. So it's
perfectly exactly what question?
The question of do our theories allow there to be an anthropic explanation? And so, you know, you gave the example of planets and habitable zones and things like that. There, you know, we understand how planets form. We understand why there is a very large distribution of planets in the universe at different distances from different stars, in different orbits, et cetera, et cetera. And therefore, we understand why some of them end up being in the right region for people like us to form and some don't. And it's that's fine. What we don't have right now, I would say, some people would disagree with this, is a completely formed theory where we can say, ah, we fully understand in this theory how quantum mechanics and gravity work together, produce either many, many, many places in the universe or produce the universe over many, many, many times in such a way that occasional that you end up with a distribution of the cosmological constant, some members of which look like the universe we live in today. So I think the anthropic explanation is perfectly logical possibility. I just don't think we know enough about our theories of gravity and particle physics to know if it's the way the world works. And so I'm glad people are working on it, and I hope someday someone can show me that that's the way it works. But in the meantime, I think it's a fruitful way to move forward to try to see if we can understand sort of microphysical ways in which things like the cosmological constant could be understood to be small.
Well, okay, but there's a prior question here. I mean, I think we agree almost too much on the question you just addressed, namely, let's imagine that there are different places in the universe. Let's allow that possibility. Mm-hmm. So then you would like to go from just stating that possibility to something quantitative. You would like to derive a prediction. You would like to say, ah, then the observed vacuum energy for a typical observer in the universe should be a certain value. And I think that I agree with, I think, with what you're saying, which is that even if someday that is possible, that day is not today. We cannot declare victory over the cosmological constant because we don't know how to do this calculation of making a prediction of what a typical person should see, or even if mm-hmm. that's the right question to ask. But then there is a prior question, which, you know, we should bring in some true skeptic to defend that position. But the prior question is, are we even allowed to be thinking about this? Is it even permissible under the ordinary rules of doing science to attempt to explain something here in the universe that we do observe by recourse to imagining a gajillion universes that we don't observe and will never observe? Or is that, I mean, the advocates for this are saying it's a wonderful new way of thinking about science, and the pessimists are saying that it is a crumbling and a treason to the only one way of doing science, which says that if you have an idea, it better be testable, or otherwise it's not science.
Well, I mean, I don't profess to have given deep philosophical thought to this, but I guess my own take is, that I don't think you could do all of science that way. You could not do all of science by saying that by recourse to a set of invisible universes which we're never going to observe, and the fact that our universe just happens to look the way it does because it allowed us to be here. But there may well be certain questions that are answerable that way once you have reached a high degree of confidence about the theory that describes things you're actually able to measure. So, for example, if you had a well-defined theory, and, you know, we've gone a long time without mentioning it, so we might as well mention it, take something like string theory, which seems to – it's a strange theory. Some people work on it. Many of them, you know, I meet, they seem very nice. Within string theory, there appears to be the possibility of being able to have something like this multiverse idea that you're discussing, the idea that we could have many, many universes, and we could therefore have many different possible values of the cosmological constant. Now, if there were never anything testable about that theory, I personally would not be prepared to accept this anthropic explanation for the cosmological constant. But if we could, through the regular process of science, test many, many things about, let's say, string theory, and become very confident that it was the right theory of quantum gravity, and that's the thing that's most amazing about string theory, that it's a quantum theory of gravity, then if an associated prediction was that the cosmological constant would be something chosen anthropically, I could live with it. I wouldn't love it. I wouldn't say that we had ultimately proven it, but at some point you would think that it was a perfectly reasonable explanation, I think.
Sadly, I just have to agree. I can't really muster any strong disagreement. I think that
but, I could, you know, call you some names with
that. It's fair to remind people that it hasn't happened yet. You know, the string theory became very popular in the 1980s, and some people leapt to the conclusion that within years we'd be predicting the mass of the electron and so forth, and none of that has happened. And there's no sign on the horizon that's going to happen soon. Nevertheless, it does predict gravity, and gravity exists, and it's the best way that we know of right now to accommodate gravity in quantum mechanics. And the important thing for me about the multiverse, as you said, and I'll just say it again to rub it in, is that the multiverse is not by itself a theory. The multiverse is, if it exists, it's a prediction of a set of ideas about the dynamics of space and time in the presence of certain kinds of quantum fields. So the thing that you should do is not complain that you can't test the idea of the multiverse. It's that you should work towards taking a theory that predicts the multiverse and also predicts something else you can test.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
We don't have that yet, but that would be the ultimate goal, and there's no statute of limitations. If we don't have it now, that doesn't mean that we're not going to get it eventually.
That's right, and it's worth pointing out, I mean, the way I said it, and I meant to say it that way, was, you know, you could imagine carrying out some completely independent set of tests of the theory you're interested in and building up a great deal of confidence that that theory is correct, and then, by the way, that theory predicts a multiverse and an anthropic explanation for the cosmological constant. Right. It is possible that you could get more than that, of course. It is possible that when, I don't suggest, by the way, that this is the way the world is going to work, but it's certainly possible that you could find, when probing the multiverse predicted by your theory, that, yes, indeed, there's a distribution of possible values of the cosmological constant, but there's an associated distribution of something else.
Yeah, okay.
I don't know what that would be, the gauge groups of particle physics, whatever it is, and that those magically have to only take certain values in universes where the cosmological constant is low and we can observe it, and that would be very interesting. In other words, if there was a sort of dependent probability. That would be a very
interesting reason. My reading of the actual work these days is that that hope is also becoming less and less hopeful.
I agree with that, but it's worth mentioning that it is something that... So I think that's true within... When you say that we're reading of the actual work, you mean string theory, I think.
Yeah.
But I'm just saying that in terms of the general question of how you might approach any theory that predicts a multiverse, that's certainly a possibility that would lead you to accept an anthropic explanation.
Well, through all this, though, at least we can hang on to the fact that we understand the 5% of the universe that is the ordinary matter that we, you know, are made of and that we see in our experiments all the time, right?
Well, we can measure it. We can't understand it, I would say. I mean, unfortunately, it's true, as you all know. So you know, you're right.
Okay, yeah.
It's true. We know each other too well. So we talked about the pie chart, of course, and pie chart has this nice 25% of dark matter that we've talked about, and this possible, I think we called it 20% of dark matter, and 75% of dark energy that we've talked about. Now, there's that sliver, that 5%, that's good old boring protons, electrons, neutrons, et cetera, et cetera. And we know about those things extremely well. The weird thing is that if you take that movie that I talked about of the universe today expanding and ran it backwards, and the universe becomes hot and dense at early times, then through regular old particle physics behavior at high temperatures, you expect equal amounts of particles, like the stuff we're made of, and their antiparticles. The particles with which, when regular matter meets them, they annihilate and become
so
radiation.
Protons, antiprotons, neutrons, antiprotons.
Electrons and positrons, neutrons, antineutrons, etc. If that were true, then there would be so little regular matter left over today that we wouldn't be here talking about this. And in fact, galaxies wouldn't be here. And nothing, and we just have a universe with dark matter and radiation,
right,
and dark energy. And so this is a big question. So this is often phrased by cosmologists in the following way. We have a universe that is composed seemingly entirely of matter, except for the antimatter we make either in colliders or by smashing protons into the upper atmosphere during cosmic rays, and devoid of primordial antimatter. And so the question is, where did this asymmetry arise? Why is there more matter than antimatter? And it goes under the fancy heading of the baryon asymmetry of the universe.
And we should stress that this is a little bit different than the problem with the vacuum energy or the problem with the difference in the numerical values of the scale of the weak interactions versus gravity. This is a real disagreement between theory and observation. This is not just an unnaturalness problem. We have within the models we think we understand a prediction for how many protons and neutrons there should be, and the answer is the same as the number of antiprotons and antineutrons. The numbers of both should be much, much, much less than what we actually see.
That's right. If you took the standard model of particle physics, which is, you know, one of the best tested theories we've ever had in science, and you ask, you know, in an expanding universe, how much matter should you have left over today, the answer is negligible. And so the fact that we are here seems to point to, again, to physics beyond what we currently know, particle physics beyond what we currently know, that would need to explain why there's more matter than antimatter. And there are a lot of ways to do this, and they're rather complicated and involved, and I'm certainly not going to inflict them on Blogging Heads TV viewers. But the point I'd like to stress is that some of them have a very nice connection to this thing we talked about with dark matter, namely the weak scale. And so there is certainly a class of explanations which come under the rather unwieldy name of electroweak baryogenesis that involve new physics at the weak scale, which will be probed with our upcoming colliders. And so perhaps a less tight connection than the dark matter one I mentioned, but a very important one, and an important way in which, you know, terrestrial experiments, albeit big ones, may be able to tell us something very fundamental about the constituents of the pie chart that we started off talking about.
So again, it's a bit of a, just to be very, very fair, a bit of a fishing expedition, because like you say, we don't know why there's an imbalance between baryons and antibaryons, protons and antiprotons, etc. And some models to explain that, and again, it's like dark matter, there are more than enough models. I mean, there's plenty of ideas
That's
in the
right.
market. It's not like dark energy where we're practically stuck. And some of these will have implications for what we see at the Large Hadron Collider, and some won't.
That's right. And I would say that that question has become more pointed in the last few years because, you know, there, as you say, there are many, many models. Some of them are quite baroque. They're quite complicated. They are motivated only by having some cute way to explain why there's more matter than antimatter. The one nice exception to this is the thing that I mentioned, namely electroweak baryogenesis. There could be some new physics at the weak scale that generates the baryon asymmetry, and that would be very exciting and be great if we could discover that in colliders. However, it's also true that in the last, you know, decade, we've discovered a little more. We've discovered that one of the particles that we have known and loved for many years, the neutrino, which we thought for a long time was massless, secretly has mass. And
did anyone really think it was massless? I mean, we hadn't detected the mass yet, but didn't most people really think that it was going to have the mass at some point?
I can't say I ever sat down and said, you know, that neutrino is going to be massive, mark my words.
But everyone had. Okay, go ahead.
I'm naive that way. But
the neutrinos do have mass. We've detected
they
that.
They do have mass.
Yeah.
And we think we have a rather good way of giving them mass, which is something called the seesaw mechanism. And that's complicated, but the real point there is
again,
that...
Again, a very macho and grandiose bit of...
It certainly beats a wimp. It's a seesaw mechanism. And the point there is that you have a rather heavy particle which partners with a neutrino and gives it mass, gives it a heavy mass. And a nice knock-on effect of something like that is that you end up with producing many, many more matter particles and antimatter particles. And those get transferred into the kinds of particles that we're made of. And so that mechanism is called leptogenesis. People had thought about it a long time ago, and they thought it was a perfectly respectable idea for generating the 5% of the pie chart that we're made of. But when neutrino masses were actually discovered, that added a lot of weight to this idea. So I would say that might be the front runner for explaining the 5% of the universe.
So you say
and if so,
leptogenesis is separate from electroweak baryogenesis.
It needs some of the same mechanisms that appear in electroweak baryogenesis, but it doesn't require that new physics to be at the weak scale.
Right.
And so it's possible you'd learn something in colliders about it, but not mandated in the way it would be for electroweak baryogenesis.
And leptogenesis, so in your judgment, that's the leading candidate right now?
I mean, all these things are just personal, right?
Sure.
But I think it's sort of compelling, and we found that neutrinos have a mass, and our simplest way of giving them a mass seems to give us a really nice way of explaining the baryon asymmetry. So it's a nice story, but nature doesn't have to behave that way.
With as few extra ingredients as possible.
That's right. That's right. We're very sparse cooks.
So, I mean, I think you can see why not everyone agrees with cosmologists when we say that we are in a golden age and we understand so much about the universe. We have 5% of the universe in ordinary matter, 20% in dark matter, 75% in dark energy, and we don't understand the origins of any of these slices of the pie chart, which if you don't sit down and think about it, lets people say, so you don't understand anything. So why are you telling me that my theory, which involves pipe cleaners and scotch tape, is not just as good as yours? But, of course, the point is that there's a small number of theoretical ideas, ordinary matter, dark matter. And the dark matter is very simple. The models that fit the data have the dark matter completely non-interacting and cold, not moving very quickly. And, in fact, one of the things that I am working on more recently is coming up with more complicated models of dark matter, where it has interactions and interesting phenomenology in the dark matter sector, just so that we can test the simple hypothesis, just so that we know we have a foil to test against. And so far,
and I've also been doing that as well.
Yeah, exactly. The simple hypothesis works. So dark matter is a simple idea, and dark energy is the simplest idea of all. Just one number, 10 to the minus 8 ergs per cubic centimeter in empty space. And with these ideas, you explain everything. You fit a tremendous amount of observational data. So it's crucial to stress, I think, that even if we don't have the once-and-for-all answers, which you almost never do in science, we do have a phenomenological model that fits very well. And I think this is a great, you know, history will remember the end of the 20th century is the time when cosmologists really put together that final recipe for what the universe is made of.
I think that's true. I'd agree with that. I mean, we have a wonderful macroscopic description of the contents of the universe. And I think the sort of spirit of what we've been saying today, people should realize, is that all these ideas are incredibly tightly constrained by observations and experiments. You know, we have tried to come up with clever ways to mess around with gravity and to play with particle physics in unexpected and baroque ways, and nature is not very kind to us. So it's true that we have yet to figure out what dark matter actually is. We have yet to fully understand cosmic acceleration. In fact, that is a real mystery, I would say, the cosmic acceleration question. But every new idea one has, first of all, the general ideas seem to be correct. The universe is accelerating. It has a certain amount of dark matter in it. It has a certain amount of regular matter in it. It expanded in a certain way. It grew in a certain way. And all those observations that support that tightly constrain any ideas you have. And then there are a whole host of theoretical constraints that we've learned of that tightly constrain any idea you would like to write down. So it's not just a free-for-all out there. You have to work pretty hard to come up with a compelling idea.
And we would all love to be the ones who figured out a better idea, right? We're not just protecting the establishment. That's not very good.
That's absolutely right. That's right. In fact, we keep coming up with these ideas, and we keep being beaten down by nature.
Well, I think, so this is great. I think we agreed on too much, and we should figure out something we really disagree about.
We should talk about the early universe next time.
You're an Indian.
We'll disagree
fan.
On all kinds of things.
We disagree about baseball.
We would disagree about baseball. We disagree about the early universe, and we disagree about football, if you knew anything about
it. Even the definition of football.
That's right.
All right. Well, maybe agreement is not such a bad thing in the blogging hands world. It might be the first time ever. But all right. Well, thanks, Mark. I think we're going to hit our stop recording buttons, and then we'll see what the audience has to say.
Okay, Sean. Nice talking to you. Talk to you again soon.
All right. Thanks.
Bye.
So